Number 16A.
We have taken that first part and have seen yesterday how we are able, when we know our categories, when we know our synonymous terms and the ideas that characterize each synonymous term, how we can really take statements, be it statements from the Bible or from the textbook, can take these statements and really elaborate on them infinitely, so that we really can go into an infinite realm, and we are no more dependent on reading sentences in the Bible and in the textbook in order to really use and live and work with the textbook and with the Bible. It gives us a bridge for creative thinking, for individual creative inspirational thinking, and this is what is necessary. So in that way we can see that we have arrived perhaps at that point again which Mrs. Eddy had foreseen, where she said in miscellaneous writings, "I foresee and foresay that every advancing epoch of truth." So she could see advancing epochs, 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 epochs of truth, so that she saw that the idea will not stand still and always remain the same thing, but that there are steps in the development of the spiritual idea, that every epoch, that every advancing epoch of truth will be characterized by a more spiritual apprehension of the scriptures. That's what we have done yesterday. We have taken just that term, creator, as the very first subject in John, and have seen through the categories of being which we know, through the seven, through the four, and the four, we have seen that we can get a higher spiritual apprehension of what the symbolism of the textbook are showing us. So that every new advancing epoch of truth will be characterized by a more spiritual apprehension of the scripture that will show, and that is what we did, that will show their marked consonance with the textbook of Christian Science. So we have really done that and have seen that we are not only sticking to the text and to the symbolism of the biblical text, and perhaps at the utmost translate really the symbols of the biblical text into metaphysical text. We have done much more than that, than just to translate symbols of yesterday into the symbols of today. We have gone much further than that. We have taken the symbols then of today, like creator, and have put it into the infinitude of being, and have put it into the seven synonymous terms, have put them into the word Christ, Christianity, and science, and we also could have done it, and we could have put it also in the category of Christian Science, absolute Christian Science, divine science, and science itself. So we really feel now that we get hold of the divine infinite calculus of calculating according to the categories of being. Now, today we go further to that second part. We will not do such a detailed interpretation. I have shown the method how to do it. So that's the most important thing, to know the method and not just show in every incident in the Bible how to do it. But now we go further and try to see that these epitomes that we have can be further detailed, so that we can put another smaller net or smaller mesh into the net. Because if we take the second part, Christ, and from the point of view of truth, and later on from the point of view of love, so if we take it first from the point of view of truth, we have come as far as to be able first as epitomizing it by the underlined epitome, That's what we have done. We have said that from the point of view of truth, we see that truth is that which manifests the Christ idea to the human, so that it gives us the sense that the Christ is the translating Christ, so we are constantly on the level of Christian Science. The whole Gospel of John is naturally all predominantly on the level of Christian Science, because it always has to do with the candlestick and explains the candlestick, and the candlestick is on the level of Christian Science. What we have to do is to explain more the mechanism of what he's showing within that candlestick, and for that we need really the textbook in order to explain the statements therein. So again, I go back to our structure. We had here the Christ from the point of view of truth, and that whole section from the point of view of truth can be epitomized, I would say, that here is shown how truth manifests the Christ idea to the human. So we have the Christ translation that is now shown. We will see the mechanism, if I may call it that way, the mechanism or the modus operandi, as Mrs. Eddy calls it, of the Christ translation. But alone to say, well, Christ translates itself to the human, and we repeat endlessly the statement that Mrs. Eddy gives in the glossary, that Christ is a divine manifestation of God that comes to the flesh to destroy incarnate error, is quite a good statement that gives light, but it is not enough. We will see that even John would use chapter and chapter and chapters, one after the other, in order to explain really the inner impact of this statement that Christ is that divine manifestation that comes to the human in order to destroy incarnate error. We must see much more clearly, or much more in detail, we must see much more the complex idea that is involved in such a short statement, in such a short definition of the Christ. And so we have considered that this epitome can first be seen from four different angles as sub-epitomes, as a sub-structure again. We have done that. We have seen the flow of the reasoning that in order that the Christ does manifest itself, we must first read the first part of the Gospel, namely the Word, must first wed that to the Christ. That's the very first step from the Word to the Christ. If you have wedded the Word to the Christ, then the second point was that then the Christ begins to work, it begins to translate itself right down to the human. And when it has translated it right down to the human, naturally for the purpose of excluding everything that is not divine and therefore establishing that which is divine, then when everything is established as divine, we have the outcome of it, the coincidence of God and man. Then there is no more duality there, there is no more a mixing up of God and the mortal and things like that, but then God and man in God's image and likeness coincide. So that furthermore, he brings in the witness or the proof that he gives that Jesus was actually the Christ, that what he has done is actually that which was promised all along the Old Testament, and that he has fulfilled really what God has promised already long ago, especially since Abraham and then through the prophets, that the Christ, the Messiah, will come. And he gives here then the proof that Jesus is actually symbolizing and presenting what has been prophesied. So that was the fourfold subtones, but we have seen that each one of the subtones has four steps in it, which is depicted here on the diagram as empty boxes. I said they are empty, not because they are empty, they are really meaningful, but from the point of view of printing, I just couldn't do it. But you have it naturally in the epitome, in this booklet. It's all in there, here. So I can always, especially when you take the last pages where we have a summary from the page 26 on, there you have all these epitomes without any further explanation of the biblical experiences. You have them there. But as you have studied them so intensely over a whole year, you remember most of the situation that John is talking about. So what I can do easily, I guess, is just to go through those empty boxes. First, the first vertical, which is empty from the Word to the Christ, which is shown in four steps. And what I will do, I will give hints to the Bible so that that it comes back to you what you have, what you already know, and just take it as a symbol. But then I want naturally to translate it into the textbook symbolism, and then further into how to use it more practically in our life. Yes, well, so the very first point that he brings up about the Christ is there, where we have the transition from the Word to the Christ. He can see that we have to be aware that we are not staying along with the Word, that the Word is not really operative, is not really saving. It needs the Christ in order that the Word is saving, the Christ consciousness. And this is naturally a big point of the Bible. We know that the Bible for a long, long, long time tells us only about the Word standpoint, and not about the Christ standpoint. As long as we read in the Bible the historical books, the Pentateuch, whatever you call it, the five book of Moses, there, and perhaps even the further historical book like Joshua, Judges, Ruth, up to the time when Samuel came along, those are the historical books, and in these historical books, we really get the hard Word without really the Christ. We get the law of the Word. We get the law of Moses. And so at that time, there is little indication that the Word is blending with the Christ. So we have the laws of the Word, which are not very agreeable when they are just the Word not combined with the Christ, namely the law, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That is the law that is still reigning today in Israel. That's the law laid down by Moses, and Moses' law, therefore, had that sense that if somebody sinned, he had to be punished. Sin must be punished. Now, this law is still laying within our consciousness. It's not only the Jewish law that is innate in the Jewish religion, it's also innate in the Christian, and very much so. Very much so, it is a feeling that if you do something wrong, you have to be punished for it. That sin brings punishment, and that's all right, and that should be so. And that was the attitude which was seen all along the Mosaic law. So that we still today suffer under that misconception that we have only somehow taken up the atmosphere of the Word and not the atmosphere of the Christ. That's why then the New Testament has become so important, because that then tries to do away with that Word alone and wed the Word with the Christ, as we will see. But I have been looking back on a greater period in time. Naturally, the Mosaic law is built on dualism, because though they had one God, that God was only the God of Israel, not the God of the world. And so there we have dualism still at being practiced, and not only being practiced, but being felt right down in our heart without thinking. We still feel, well, if somebody does wrong, he has to be punished, and has to be punished properly. That's the law of Moses, and it's still incorporated in our laws, civil laws. It's still incorporated in our consciousness. And naturally, as long as it's incorporated in our consciousness, all the laws will be according to that. So what is necessary is that first our consciousness changes away from the Mosaic law to the law of the Christ, which is quite different, which would also mean, just as John is saying, that said of Jesus, that Jesus is not come to condemn but to save. He's not coming to punish, he's not coming to fulfill the Mosaic law, but that he's come really to save. And to save means that you have only one reality, that you are not accepting evil as a reality, so that we are able to translate really evil into good. So the first indication we had in this line when we read the Bible came with Deutero-Isaiah. Deutero-Isaiah is that Isaiah from chapter 40 onward. And that second Isaiah, as he is also called, has a completely different message than the first Isaiah. There in the second Isaiah, or Deutero-Isaiah as it's also called, we see that suddenly Israel woke up to the one God, really to the monistic God, that God which is the God and the one God for the whole world, not only the God for Israel. But you see, up to that point they said, well, we Israelites have only one God, but the other nations can have their gods. It's all right. We don't mind as long as we don't mix them up with our God. So it was a national monistic God. But then with the second Isaiah, they began to see that there is only one Lord, and that therefore the world is governed by one Lord. And so that was the introduction, really, into real spiritual monism, away from dualism. But it took a long time, some 100 years, and to have that idea being expressed clearly and naturally by Jesus. So these great epochs always take time for a new paradigm to break through. But we can see that really from the time of the prophets onward, especially, as I said, from Isaiah and afterwards from Ezekiel onward, very strongly the word is being wedded to the Christ, so that they accepted only one presence of the Lord, and that that Lord was omnipresent, not only in Israel, but in the whole world. What then about sin that should be punished? What about that law of Moses? And they began to see that everything that is not of the nature of God, of that monistic spiritual reality, is actually non-existent. And that that we have to see that that is resolving itself into nothingness. So that animal magnetism is now seen no more as an enemy that has to be fought, but as something that has to be translated back into spirit. So that duality is resolved by translation, and not by punishment, not by destruction. That's the case also with everything that we have to meet, be it disease. We don't have to destroy a disease. We have to see that we translate it back to its original position, namely to health, and back to an idea that is operating within the divine principle. So we don't destroy really disease. Though Mrs. Eddy sometimes uses that term, that truth destroys error, we must always think that language is usually not quite adequate, and sometimes that we have to use abbreviations instead of always saying that truth comes to the belief of error and translates the belief of error back into an understanding of truth. That's a long statement. You can have a shorthand explanation, say truth destroys error. But again, you see, we come to the point, that's a statement, we must understand it, or else if we take it just as terms, we have a sense that truth is like a sledgehammer and that comes to error and really beats on error as long until error is knocked down, which is not true. You see, that's a mosaic imagery, but the Christ is something else. The Christ is that makes also nothing of error, but not by destroying with force, but by really retranslating error back into its original truth. Because any error is a misunderstanding of truth. It's not something by itself, it has no existence by itself, it has no reality by itself, it has no entity by itself. There is not such an entity called error. Error is only a misunderstanding of the truth. So if we mistranslate truth, we have error. If we mistranslate spirit, we have matter. If we mistranslate immortal mind, we have mortal mind. So all these so-called errors have no reality. They don't exist somewhere as an entity. They are only a belief. They are only an illusion about a truth. And so in this way, right from that point of Isaiah and Ezekiel, they began to see right through that question of apparent dualism, and began to see that there is no dualism, but the method of translating apparent dualism to monism is through the Christ translation, through combining really the Word with the Christ. And that has taken a few hundred years in order to sink in, so that at the point of Jesus, really the clarity of it was brought out, and was brought out so clearly that one could see it. Just as the first epistle of John says right at the beginning, that the Christ has come, and we could see it with our eyes, and we could handle it with our hands. It was tangible even to the human consciousness, so that it could not be mistaken. We must perhaps also think about this rather shorthand description usually which we have for error, because we say, well, all error, all disease, all sin, all disharmony can be brought back to mortal mind and have a common denominator, mortal mind. And usually we leave it at that, or usually the textbooks leaves it at that. You have many statements in the textbook that just go as far as that, that they say, well, all evil is actually not reality, they don't exist, it only exists in mortal mind, that the cause of all disease is mortal mind. But that is not going back far enough, because it leaves the thought there that there is mortal mind, and on the other hand, that there is divine mind. And so we must also understand that Mrs. Eddy could not in every case repeat herself and repeat herself and repeat herself in order to explain that. But there are various statements, like one of the clearest one I found was in Unity of God, on page 35, where she says, reduced to its proper denomination, matter is mortal mind, period. So that's what Mrs. Eddy usually says in the textbook also. But here in Unity of Good, she adds another sentence and says, yet, strictly speaking, we cannot always speak strictly, or we would have to use too many words and too many sentences and explaining all over again the same thing. So we need these shorthand expressions. So she says, yet, strictly speaking, there is no mortal mind. So first she says, the cause is mortal mind, as if it would be a cause. But then she goes on and says, but strictly speaking, there is no mortal mind, for mind, capital M, is immortal and is not matter, but spirit. So here she brings it right back to the origin. She brings back all that is of the nature of evil and matter, so brings it right back to mortal mind, and then mortal mind way back to the divine mind, as to say, this divine mind is the only spirit, is the only reality. So she uses here two sentences, so to say, for a short insight which we have, that matter is not real, that there is only one reality, and that is spirit. So we have to see these things from time to time, so that we don't fall into a superficial language, into a superficial consciousness, which just uses terms and sentences, and we are not realizing what they really mean. So, in the period before Jesus arrived, we had actually those prophets which began to see that all that was evil can be analyzed through the divine mind, can be uncovered through spirit, and can be annihilated through soul. And with annihilation, she means not destroying. Annihilate means to bring back to nothingness, to reduce back to illusion, to nothingness. It's not destroying that sledgehammer theory, but that it is resolved into the oneness of being, so that there that they could see, especially in Ezekiel, that there is no duality, that really that which seemed to be evil can be restored, can be retranslated through the system of principle, then in life restored to its native somethingness, and so bring about then the holy city, the consciousness of the holy city, where the Lord alone is there. So in this way, the Old Testament is showing those two great periods of the Word and the Christ, and shows that if one blends those two together, then we are at the point where the New Testament can start and can make sense.